And they sing pretty darn well, too. Thank you. Thank you. Our first reading today is an excerpt from the foundational essay, White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Backpack by Peggy McIntosh. This piece was mentioned in a reading used here 2 weeks ago today. I thought it would be useful to return to it directly.
As a white person, I realized I had been taught about racism as something which puts others at a disadvantage, but had been taught not to see one of its corollary aspects, white privilege, which puts me at an advantage. So I have begun in an untutored way to ask what it is like to have white privilege. I have come to see white privilege as an invisible package of unearned assets, which I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. White privilege is like an invisible, weightless backpack of special provisions, maps, passports, code books, visas, clothes, tools, and blank checks. My schooling gave me no training in seeing myself as an unfairly advantaged person or as a participant in a damaged culture. I was taught to see myself as an individual whose moral state depended on her individual moral will. My schooling followed the pattern of my colleague, Elizabeth Minich, as she has pointed out that whites are taught to think of their lives as a morally neutral, informative, or normative, and average, also ideal, so that when we work to benefit others, this is seen as work which will allow them to be more like us.
Our second reading this morning is by technology journalist Farhad Manju. His story, Exposing Hidden Bias at Google, was published last month in the New York Times. I hope that it is clear in the piece that this is not a denigration of Google. The company is making a serious look at a problem that pervades much more than just Silicon Valley. His article begins this way. Google, like many tech companies, is a man's world. Started by a pair of men, its workforce remains dominated by men. In a report to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission last year, Google said that of its 36 executives and top-ranking managers, just 3 are women. Google's leaders say they are unhappy about the firm's poor gender diversity and about the underrepresentation of blacks and Hispanics among its workforce. And so they're undertaking a long-term effort to improve these numbers, the centerpiece of which is a series of workshops aimed at making Google's culture more accepting of diversity. The workshops are based on an emerging field of social psychology known as unconscious bias. These are hidden, reflective preferences that shape most people's worldviews and that can profoundly affect how welcoming and how open a workplace is to different people and ideas. Google's interest in hidden biases was sparked in 2012 when the company's director of human resources, Laszlo Bock, read about a study that showed systematic discrimination against female applicants for scientific jobs. The effect was so pervasive that researchers theorized that discrimination must be governed by unconscious cultural biases rather than overt sexism It was just too everywhere. Citing research that shows diverse teams can be more effective and creative than homogeneous ones, Mr. Bach argued that a diverse workforce could be good for Google's business. Could Google, then, investigate how biases were affecting people's work? And more importantly, could it change its own culture? Google's human resources group functions like a graduate school research lab, with staff scientists who are analyzing the company's internal operations. Mr. Bach asked one of those researchers, Brian Wella, to begin a project on hidden biases at Google. After a few months, Dr. Wella came up with a 90-minute lecture targeted specifically at a skeptical, scientifically minded Google employee. In the lecture, Dr. Wella shows a computer simulation of how a systematic 1% bias against women in performance evaluations scores can trickle up through the ranks, leading to a severe underrepresentation of women in senior management. Finally, Dr. Wella points to research showing that we aren't slaves to our hidden biases. The more we make ourselves aware of the role our unconscious plays in our decision-making, and the more we try to force or encourage others to confront their own hidden biases, the greater the chance we have of overcoming our own hidden preferences. Google offered several anecdotes that seemed to indicate a less biased culture as a result of their training program. Not long ago, the company opened a new building, and someone spotted the fact that all the conference rooms were named after male scientists. In the past, that might have gone unmentioned, but this time, the names were changed. Another time, in an all-company presentation, an interviewer asked a male and female manager who had recently begun sharing an office, "Which one of you does the dishes?" This strange, sexist undertone of this question was immediately seized upon by a worker who yelled, "Unconscious bias!" Mr. Bach saw all of these actions as evidence that the training was working. He said, "Suddenly you go from being completely oblivious to going, 'Oh my God, it's everywhere.'" Thank you, Nathan. young man by the name of Tal Fortgang had an interesting first year in college last year. A freshman at Princeton, he caused a bit of a stir during the spring with an article he wrote for the school's conservative student newspaper, The Tory. This is how he begins. There is a phrase that floats around college campuses, Princeton being no exception, that threatens to strike down opinions without regard to their merits, but rather solely rests on the basis of the person that voiced them. Check your privilege, the saying goes, and I have been reprimanded by it several times this year. The phrase handed down by my moral superiors descends recklessly like an Obama-sanctioned drone and aims laser-like at my pinkish peach complexion, my maleness, and my nerve for displaying and offering an opinion rooted in my personal Weltanschauung. If you're Princeton, you can use German words in your, well, yeah, you are as pretentious as you sound. Check your privilege, they tell me, in a command that teeters between an imposition to actually explore how I got where I am and a reminder that I ought to feel personally apologetic because white males seem to pull most of the strings in the world. That got people's attention. Fortgang was interviewed not once but twice by Fox News. Fox News had noticed the article about Cal Fortgang in the New York Times, called it an attack on him, and brought him in to testify. They didn't let him talk all that long. He got to throw in the word heteronormative, which was really good. I'm not sure they knew what to do with that if they knew what it was. My biases are showing, forgive me, folks. And so Mr. Fortgang is a political conservative, but he is not inherently evil. He's calling something out that exists, and but he doesn't use a phrase that I have just been informed of that really lies at the center of what I want to share with you this morning. Because he's saying, when he's been challenged to check his privilege, that he's been called out. That phrase lands like a judgment to shut the white man up. Sometimes that's appropriate, perhaps. But rather than a calling out, when we ask people to check their privilege, and I have been asked to check mine appropriately so, we all need corrections every now and then, at least, but there's a way to do it in a way that we call calling in, which is an invitation into fuller dialogue, an invitation into fuller community. And so this morning, I want to encourage all of us, I want to shout out a call in for all of us. People are privileged differently from one another, and some of us may have privilege in one area and not in another. And like the proverbial fish, when asked to describe water, goes, huh? If you're thinking, huh? Well, maybe you just haven't had those experiences where you bump up against what privilege you do have. And so now I come over here and we have a little conversation. The first time I think, looking back in my life, I was able to name privilege happened when I was a freshman, not in college, but in high school. My family had moved 2 weeks after I finished middle school from a town that used to be called Park Forest South in Illinois. It's now called University Park. I think it's still one of the southernmost suburbs of Chicago. To the north were other towns. To the south were winter wheat fields. And when I wanted to get out of the house, I would roam with my dog named Boomer. It's real. And we would run in those fields, and the world, the fields, the hills would restore me. 2 weeks after finishing middle school, we moved from Park Forest South to a little unincorporated area tucked in between Lake Forest, Deerfield, and Bannockburn, Illinois. These are where doctors and lawyers live. We moved there because it was equidistant. My father was working in a pharmaceutical plant just north of Chicago, a town called Skokie. And my mom was working as a public health nurse for the county whose offices were in Waukegan. Deerfield had really good schools, and so we picked that. Folks picked that. On the first day of school, I went to Deerfield High School. My brother went to Bannockburn Junior High. Bannockburn, how to describe this? This is the North Shore's horsey set. All right? You get that? Later, I would do yard work for a woman named Catherine. I won't tell you her last name. She insisted everyone called her Kitty, and she wore white tennis clothes all the time. That was her uniform. My brother came home from school from Bannockburn Junior High in tears. All day long, this first day of a new school, he had been bullied all day long. Why? Because he was wearing Sears Toughskin jeans, not Lee's or Levi's. So mom and dad said, Glenn, suck it up, tough it up. They're just showing you whatever. They're being jerks. Don't let that get to you. So armed with that family value stuff, he went back to school the next day, and you know what happened? He was teased even worse and came home a puddle. And I was his younger brother. I used to be the one who beat on him, and other people were now beating on my brother, and there wasn't anything I could do. So we came home from school the second day, and mom and dad looked in their checking account, and they said, yeah, we have enough. We're going to the mall. You're getting Lee's. I got Levi's. It's just one of those things. And I came away with that with two impressions. The first was that I really didn't like rich people, which is a judgment that has not served me well, but has been very hard to outgrow. It's gotten in the way when I have seen rich person instead of a person that would be getting to know. And the second thing is, I learned the importance of being able to dress up. I have friends that live in Upper Arlington who have two young boys. I've talked about them before. The boys aren't really big on sports, and they were getting ribbed in the schools because they weren't wearing OSU attire. And so Danielle and Eric went and got them, get this, this is Danielle's phrase, I love it, protective camouflage. I wish I had had that phrase when I was in high school. You know what, folks? This suit is my protective camouflage. So hold on. Because there are times it gets in the way. Rah. I still wear the stole because you know what? You gave it to me. Members of this congregation, this was a gift and I'm very, very appreciative. And so as a white male, I learned that I could pass if I dressed the part. Friends in high school, we did as many things that weren't necessarily legal as other groups of kids, but we were wearing Izod shirts. We got away with it. We got away with it almost every time. We didn't do anything different than the burnouts. That's what we called that group in my high school days. But we dressed like we weren't that way. We donned clothes to give us privilege. The second little story I want to tell from my life, just as a way of saying, you know, we need to call each other in. We need to be able to share our stories. These things are, there's no smooth way forward to learn about this stuff. There are going to be bumps on the road. So I'm telling you stories of my life to say, these are some bumps I know. What are the bumps you know? That's why I'm telling that story, and that's why I'm going to tell you this next one. Many of you know my partner, Anne, is Black Jamaican. She's actually a quarter Chinese, but no one sees that. Not long ago, I took her adult children out to dinner at a restaurant not that far from here. And if you look at them, you would say African-American. And maybe that's how they identify, but I think they really identify as Jamaican. And we sat down, and we waited. And after a while, glasses of water came to the table. And we waited. And we waited. And after a while, we got menus. And we waited. Other people were sitting down. Other people's orders were being taken. We were waiting. Finally, our orders were taken, and I said, "Excuse me, other people are getting their food who came in after us." "Oh, no, oh, no, oh, no." "Oh, yeah." And I realized one of those things that I had heard, that Black folks don't get waited on necessarily well all the time, I was experiencing for the first time. I was 48 years old, and I'm experiencing this for the first time. I went and told a friend of mine who's African-American and teaches at OSU. I told him this story. I was like, "Well, I don't know him that well, but I want to get to more, and I just, you know, going to tell this story." And I tell him the story, and he laughs right in my face. And I'm thinking, "Oh, damn." Try to be a little vulnerable. I get laughter back. Okay. And then I wanted to look down and keep looking down, but I looked back up. I looked at his expression. And you know what? His expression wasn't saying, "You stupid white guy." His expression was saying, "Welcome to the rest of the human race." Relationship restored. Relationship restored. Last Saturday night, it was a work night for me, so I didn't see it directly. Debbie Shaw brought it to my attention. There was a great, if edgy, skit on Saturday Night Live. Does anyone watch that show? Oh, my God. Wow. You guys are much cooler than me. Did you see the skit on white people? You DVR'd it. All right. Technology I don't understand. And it was really, really biting, but very funny. It goes like this. "We're whites, and for now we're on top. We've had a great run, but we know it won't last forever. So for these final years of white dominance, we're going to soak it all in." Ouch! Ouch! And then it closed by saying, you know, "We've got a good run. Maybe until 2050 or maybe 2060, we'll still be in charge." Well, folks, I don't know about that. I don't know about you, but I don't know if I want to be in charge. Do you? Would you really? I want to be with. I want to be on the playground playing with people. I don't want to be a little emperor in clothes, a Boston Brahmin. And I asked Debbie, when Debbie found that story, I was like, "That's perfect." Because the Unitarians in New England used to be the Brahmin set. They were called the Boston Brahmins. That's part of the DNA of our religious tradition. Thankfully, the Universalists joined us, and the Universalists were a little more folksy. And these are wide generalizations, but there's still something to it. There's still something to it. So, calling in and calling out. Calling out is saying, check your privilege, I'm dismissing you, I don't have anything to do with you. That's judgment, that's calling out. Calling in is saying, you know, I think there's an edge to what you're saying there. You might want to explore that. Let's explore that together. Let's share our stories. Let's go through the bumpy parts of this and see what it feels like on the other side. Calling in and calling out. Calling out shuts down. Calling in makes community. Join me in calling in. Thank you.